Thank you. Can you all hear me? All right, so the theme of this meeting is stasis and disequilibrium in the Milky Way, and my talk will very much focus on the disequilibrium aspect of it, since that's one of the things that cosmological simulations give us quite naturally, and perhaps it can help inform some of the limitations, or at least warning flags of certain applications where we may need to worry about this disequilibrium aspect. So you're seeing here a panel through one of my latte simulations, part of the fire simulation project, and you can just see at least for this particular simulation, it's undergoing a minor merger right around redshift zero. But it just gives you a sense of the structure that's in these current generations of cosmological zoom-in simulations. Just to give you another picture of these, I'm going to show you... Well, that's interesting. We're frozen. I think I got it now. No, I do not. There we go. All right, so two views of the Milky Way. One of these is real, one of these is fake. The top is our own Milky Way. I put it upside down and clipped the Magellanic Clouds to confuse some of you, although some of you probably saw through that pretty easily. And then this is a mock Gaia DR2 survey we've created. This is work led by Robin Sanderson, who will be talking a little bit later, creating synthetic Gaia surveys from these simulations. Just to give you sort of a visual of where we are being able to create sort of realistic Milky Way-like galaxies from fully cosmological simulations. And again, everything I'm going to tell you today is part of the FIRE simulation project. I list some of the faculty involved here, but I also want to emphasize in particular contributions from graduate students and postdocs that I'll try to highlight in this talk. Shang-Sheng Ma, who's a TAC fellow at Berkeley, Shay Garrison Kimmel, who's an Einstein fellow at Caltech, and two grad students, Karim El-Badri at Berkeley and Gunjan Lakhani, who's working with Norm Murray at the University of Toronto. I'm also going to try to highlight some of the work of my own relatively new and growing galaxy simulation group at Davis, so Sarah Loban, who's a Hubble fellow with us, Samantha Benincasa, who just started as a postdoc, three graduate students, Jenna Samuel, Isaiah Stendi-Stevan, and Matt Baraldini, and some nice work from an undergraduate, in fact, Sierra Chapman. So a quick outline of my talk. It'll basically have three parts. I'll start by telling you a little bit about the input physics model we put into these simulations. Then I'll discuss the properties of the Milky Way-like disks that emerge from these simulations. And then finally, I'll touch on the properties of the satellite dwarf galaxies that form naturally in these cosmological simulations. So a bit on our assumed physics model, and so here's where I give basically a three-slide summary of all the physics we put in, which is woefully inadequate. I mean, I could spend the whole 30 minutes trying to tell you what we do here, and of course, because I want to show you some of the interesting results. I do fear a little bit, though, for many of you who don't work on these hydro simulations, that it can seem a little bit of a black box. It's hard to understand all the microphysics that goes in. So I'll try to give you a high-level summary, but I very much encourage during our 15-minute discussion, I think that's a very important thing for us to discuss, and if you have questions and other simulators in the room, perhaps it could be fruitful to have a little bit of discussion on that aspect of it. Our perspective within FIRE, our overarching goal is to try to model in a fully cosmological setting, as best we can, of course it won't be perfect, but to try to model dense multi-phase interstellar medium that forms galaxies. So one of the things this means is pushing on resolution as much as we can. So the current Milky Way mass simulations I'll show you have individual baryonic particle masses of a few thousand solar masses, and we have fully adaptive spatial resolution that gets down to just a few parsecs in the gas and in the stars. We also try to model gas, including the cold gas, down to 10 Kelvin. And I think one of the most important things that we try to model is how stars form, and in particular, in our simulations, we impose that stars only form in dense, self-gravitating molecular clouds, which is what we observe in the Milky Way. And we're starting to be able to resolve the molecular clouds themselves, so we can start to have a good estimate of where stars actually should form in these simulations. Okay, so again, a very brief summary of the model for stellar evolution and stellar feedback. So again, our overarching goal here is, as we're being able to push down to resolutions of a few thousand solar mass star particles, is that means we're starting to be able to model not individual stars, of course, but at least individual stellar populations. We're getting down to star particle masses that are comparable to star clusters, right? And so that's a nice sort of place to be, because at least then we can model stellar populations as simple mono-age, mono-abundance populations to put in the stellar evolution models on top of that. And so the three major feedback channels we include are supernova, that's core collapse and more delayed 1A, stellar radiation, so this includes radiation pressure, this includes photoionization heating that drives H2 regions, and this also includes photoelectric heating off of dust, and then finally, of course, stellar winds, right? They're dominated largely by young, massive O and B stars, but also in a more delayed sense by AGB stars. Again, I could give a whole 30-minute talk on this, but this is just a high-level overview. If you have any more questions, by all means. And then finally, because I'll touch on it in my talk, one of the nice things that cosmological simulations give you, at least in principle, is self-consistent enrichment and the formation of metals out of initially pristine gas. So in our simulation, we tracked 11 total abundances. So this includes 9 metals that you can see listed here. There are 3 channels for nucleosynthesis in our simulations, core collapse supernova, 1A supernova, and stellar winds. So when you see our predictions for abundances, this is the 3 channels that they're coming from. Okay, so that's all I want to say about the underlying physics model. Now I want to move on to talking about the actual simulations themselves. So these are cosmological zoom-in simulations. So just for those of you who aren't cognoscenti, what we do is we start with a large cosmological volume that's dark matter only. We run it down to redshift 0, and then we're free to select any region we want to re-simulate at as high of resolution as we can. Then we go back to the initial conditions at redshift 100, regenerate these particles at very high resolution with gas allowing star formation, and then run it down to redshift 0. So this is all low resolution dark matter only, but we can put all of our simulation power into this zoom-in region, which for the simulations I'll show you here is typically a few megaparsecs across. So we can look at both the Milky Way disk, the satellite galaxies around it, and sort of the local field like dwarf galaxies that form around them. Most of the simulations I've been leading, the Latte suite, are individual Milky Way mass simulations we've zoomed in on, but now Shea Garrison Kimmel has led a couple of local group-like systems where we find Milky Ways next to M31s. And so we can see if that has any importance for aspects of disk formation or of the satellite galaxies. So this movie just shows you what the formation of one of these Milky Way-like galaxies looks like. This first movie zooms out all the way out to scales of the Vera radius at redshift 0. And on the right, you can see the gas color-coded by temperature. And on the left, you can see a mock real color image of the stars forming self-consistently out of that gas. So let me just restart the movie. So you can see the initial Hubble expansion and then the collapse. You can see the filamentary collapse of the gas here. You can see what the early Milky Way-like sort of volume looked like here. And then as this evolves down, you can see the formation of a disk embedded here. Of course, most of your eye picks up, though, the dwarf galaxies in the stellar halo. So I'll just let you watch this for the next 30 seconds. Yes, so that's one thing we do, admittedly fairly crudely, is we have a spatially uniform but redshift-dependent metagalactic UV background. This is one of the drawbacks of zoom-ins, is you really can't try to self-consistently model photoionization from, you know, large Hubble volumes.
So you suddenly switched on the background.
Well, the background is continuous, so this is taken from Claude-André Fréchet-Jaeger's compilation in 2009, but it does, you know, there is a sharp, for that particular UV background has a sharp ionization somewhere around redshift 10. We now think it's a bit early, and we're working on using updated UV backgrounds that reionize more at like redshift 7, 7.5.
Did you say you formed dust grains?
The dust grains are estimated based on, you assume a fixed dust to gas metallicity ratio to estimate the photoelectric heating. So there's admittedly no self-consistent dust tracking. It's just assuming that it tracks the gas phase metallicity. So here's what it looks like at redshift 0. You can see a cold gas disk embedded within a hot halo, and then you can see a stellar disk here embedded within a stellar halo, tidal features, dwarf galaxies result there.
Are we seeing the left-hand panel, the luminous
star? Yes, I'll show you images of dark matter later. But these simulations do include dark matter, cold, vanilla cold dark matter. Although that's something else we're working on, but that's another talk. So here's a sort of gallery image of our the 12 Milky Way mass simulations we've completed so far, 8 part of my Latte suite, and then 2 local group-like pairs, so that's 4 halos, part of Shea's Elvis suite. And just to give you a sense here of what these disks look like at redshift 0, some of them are reasonably nice Milky Way analogs, but of course some of them aren't. And so it's one of the challenges of using cosmological simulations is, unlike, say, the nice talk that Shervin gave, where you can try to isolate particular features of the Milky Way, you sort of get what you get, and then you sort of have to choose the questions you ask that allow you to generalize that maybe these bracket certain features of the Milky Way formation, even though, of course, we're not getting any exact Milky Way-like analogs in these simulations. All right, so let me tell you a little bit about the properties of these Milky Way-like disks here. So I'm going to show you another movie. This time is just zooming in on the disk region, so you can actually see how the disk forms in one of these simulations. And often people note that this looks quite violent and turbulent and bursty, but I will note that, as I'll show you in just a moment, this particular simulation happens to form a very Milky Way-like thin disk at redshift zero. So I'm not saying this is how the Milky Way formed, but I'm saying this is one channel to end up with a galaxy that's not unlike the Milky Way.
So are these big explosions in the...
We think so. I mean, if you talk to anyone who does high redshift galaxy observations, it's pretty ubiquitous to see massive galactic winds coming off of, you know, redshift 2-3 galaxies. And we're, of course, in the process of trying to compare those more directly by doing mock molecular observations to test molecular outflows, but qualitatively, yes, I do believe that those are realistic. Tristan?
It looks like the explosions are throwing the stars out. Is that just the dust?
No, that's happening, and I think Anna is looking at this in detail. We actually think, at least in our simulations, a non-trivial fraction of the stellar halos are formed from molecular clouds that are actually getting kicked out but remain star-forming. And this is also actually observed, some very nice recent results from the MANGA survey of seeing star-forming molecular outflows coming off of some disk galaxies today. It's related. It's also driven by gas outflows, although there on dwarf galaxy scales, it's even much more dramatic and violent. So similar physics, but slightly different phenomenology, shall we say. So now you can just see here the Milky Way-like disk that's formed, the cold gas disk that's forming these stars by redshift zero. Okay, so first I'd like to say a little bit about the gas in these disks, in particular trying to model the cold ISM and molecular clouds, since that's one of our goals. So this is a work being led by Gunjan Lakhani, a grad student at University of Toronto, working with Nora Murray, and also Samantha Benacasa, a postdoc working with me at Davis. So this just shows you a top-down image of cold gas in one of our disks. Now we can make a map of the CO brightness temperature. This is actually what's observed in the Milky Way, and then this is a mock view from inside one of our simulations. So as a function of galactic longitude, the y-axis shows the line of sight velocity of the CO. You can see the thin cold gas disk of the Milky Way here. You can see the inner sort of molecular ring, that's this tilt you see here. And then if you look at our simulations, you can see qualitatively similar structure. Our gas disk in this particular case looks like it's a bit more turbulent. I think this gas disk has about a factor of 2 higher gas surface density than the Milky Way, so that might help explain that. But this is something we're looking at here. But I just show it to you to highlight our ability to get at least qualitatively similar cold ISM gas distributions as compared with the Milky Way. Molecular clouds as well. Here's a map of molecular clouds in one of our simulations, and we're able to at least start resolving the formation and dissolution of molecular clouds in these disks. So this shows a comparison of that. So here's basically the mass function, so the number of cold molecular clouds as a function of their mass. This blue/green curve here is what's observed in the Milky Way. Of course, taking this compilation peaks at masses around 10 to the 5. We can't resolve arbitrarily low molecular clouds in these simulations. We can resolve them down to about 10 to the 5. And this yellow gold curve here shows you what we get in one of these simulations compared to what's observed in the Milky Way. Not a perfect agreement, of course, but I think it's at least compelling that we're able to get mass functions that are resembling at least those we observe in the Milky Way. We get a few too many high-mass molecular clouds there. We're working to understand that. But again, I want to emphasize, we're able to start resolving molecular clouds, which, of course, are, from a pure dynamics point of view, also important because they provide fine-grained structure in the ISM. And if you want to, you know, model scattering of stars, this is one thing you might want to have in a simulation like this to get that right. Okay, so moving on to the properties of the stellar disks in these simulations. So here was that movie I showed you before. Here's now an image of that stellar disk at redshift zero. So here's a top-down view with estimates of the dust attenuation, and here's an edge-on view. You can kind of see a very thin disk here, and it's hard to see on this monitor, but it's embedded within a thick disk here. Yeah, in this particular case, it is slightly lopsided, that's right. Yeah, I'm trying to remember if this one has a satellite perturber. I don't remember off the top of my head. M12i, I don't think it does. Stellar mass can comparable to what the Milky Way is. And so we can look at the vertical structure of these disks, since, of course, for a long time, that was quite a challenge in cosmological simulations, is getting the vertical structure of these disks correctly. So this is a paper we had a few years ago led by Shang-Sheng Ma, who's now a postdoc at Berkeley, and he quantified at the solar circle what the vertical stellar density was in at least one of our first simulation like this, and the black points here basically show the fit to the vertical density profile is well fit by thin and thick disk components that have scale heights quite comparable to what we have in the Milky Way. So again, just proof of principle that there's no problem in these latest generations of cosmological simulations self-consistently forming thin stellar disks embedded within thick stellar disks. How does this question? No, I think that's well within the uncertainty.
How many particles in this disk?
Star particles, there's about 10 million. And there would be a comparable number of cold gas particles. No, that's not right. There would be about a few million cold gas particles in this disk. In the entire zoom-in region, there's about 100 million particles.
So how did the thick disk form in this situation?
Good question. So I think it's fair to say this is basically consensus view now amongst people who do cosmological simulations, and also consistent with basically all observations of high redshift galaxies, that in the early formation stages of these disks, which you can see in the movies, they were forming as thick disks, or if you want to call them disks. There's rotation support, but they're almost spheroidal in their morphology. And then as the accretion rates into the galaxy go down, as the universe keeps expanding, the disks settle down, and eventually settle down into a thin gas disk morphology, out of which form a thin disk of stars. We do see vertical heating in these simulations, so I'm not saying that doesn't happen, but at least to the extent that we've looked at it, it is a minority population of what you might ascribe to the thick disk. So in this case, I think about 25% of what you might call thick disk stars were heated from the thin disk. The majority of them simply formed as in-situ thick disk stars. So the picture that I know John Byrd has been saying for a while now, you can think of the radial evolution as inside out, but the vertical evolution is upside down. And again, I think this is basically consensus of everyone who's done cosmological simulations. Anyone want to disagree with me, by all means, but. Right, so, I mean, this is basically looking at the disk as a whole. Of course, you can have deviations looking at the bulge region versus the outer disk, but by and large, this is the picture of how the entire disk forms. I think it would be more dramatic if you look, obviously, out in the outer disk. The inner disk forms somewhat earlier, somewhat more accretion-driven, right? There is some thin disk structure there as well, so there's relatively different amounts, but I think this is a picture across the whole disk.
And your scale length for the thickened component is short, isn't it, compared to the thin?
The radial scale length.
Yeah.
Yes, the shorter than the thin for sure, yes. I don't remember off the top of my head what they are for this particular one. Okay, so switching gears a little bit, I also want to talk about interesting things that emerge from the elemental abundance patterns of stars in these disks. So I think one of the most striking features, if we look in the Milky Way, that I think is generally agreed upon now is these multiple tracks in the alpha to iron versus iron space. And question has been lingering, what drives not just a single track, but multiple tracks in this space? So we have 12 Milky Way mass simulations to look at. Most of them look like this, which is what I would have naively expected, which is basically, with scatter, a single track in alpha to iron space. But we do have two, and only two out of 12, simulations that show multiple tracks that are not exactly like the Milky Way, but I think they're at least promising direction of being able to form multiple distinct alpha tracks. Qualitatively similar to what we see in the Milky Way. So the question, so just again, I want to point out, this is not all galaxies. This is about a sixth of our Milky Ways. So a prediction would be this may not be ubiquitous in the universe. This may be a feature of the way that the Milky Way formed. So how do these multiple tracks emerge in our simulations? Well, so what's nice about the simulations is now you can break down iron abundance and then alpha to iron abundance as a function of stellar age. You can see what's going on here. For the oldest stars, right, so they're getting enriched, iron abundance is going up, but there's a break about redshift 1, and then star formation starts again, but at a significantly lower iron abundance and keeps rising again. Look at alpha to iron, starts high as you expect as the core collapse start polluting initially, comes down as the 1As kick in, there's a break, then almost keeps going, there's maybe a burst that drives up alpha a little bit, and then it keeps coming back down. So what seems to be happening, at least in the two that we see, is there's a break in the star formation history that offsets the iron abundance, but doesn't that much affect the alpha to iron abundance. What drives this? Well, you could probably guess. It's a gas-rich major merger. So in this case, it's a slightly less than LMC satellite that comes in. So the stellar mass ratio isn't close, but what's particularly notable about this merger is the gas ratios are almost 1-to-1. And so that's enough to really renormalize down the iron abundance in this proto-Milky Way and bring down the iron abundance so that if you look on this track, what's happening, the galaxy starts off here, comes down to the right, there's a break in the star formation history because of the merger, star formation starts over here and then continues to track on down like this. All right, one of the things that I think makes this scenario interesting, and this is something that Sarah Loban has started looking at, these two simulations that show these multiple alpha tracks also have, if you look at their stellar halos at redshift 0, features that are quite resemble the Gaia sausage or Enceladus, or as I like to call it, the enchilada. And so what I think is promising is that these may in fact be manifestations of the same thing, a gas-rich merger that happened some gig years ago, and I think an interesting question is if we can use the combination of these to age date it, but that both gave rise to the structure in the stellar halo and gave rise to the offset in these alpha tracks. I'm convinced now that I think these are part of the same event. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip a few slides. And in the last few minutes, talk a little bit about the satellite dwarf galaxies that form around our disks. So moving out of our disks, just some interesting results that have emerged on our predictions for the satellite galaxies. So we can look at the mass function of satellite galaxies, so the number of dwarf galaxies as a function of their stellar mass. We had a paper out fairly recently that Shea Garrison Kimmel led that looked at all of our full 12 Milky Way mass simulations, so we have reasonable statistics now, and comparing them to Milky Way. All right, so here's the Milky Way, here's M31, and then all these curves, different color curves, are just different ones of our different simulations, Milky Way mass simulations. And you can see, as we've been noting in my previous paper, that basically we find across the scatter in our simulations quite consistent with what we measure in the Milky Way. We find a few that are closer to M31. M31 does seem to have more than most of our simulations, but at least if you compare to the Milky Way, we basically bracket the scatter. So again, just to reemphasize, if you haven't heard me say it already, or if you haven't heard other people say it already, there simply is no missing satellites problem, at least down to what we can resolve, which is about the classical dwarf limit of 10 to the 5. We can't yet, for these simulations, address the ultra faints yet. But again, no missing satellites problem. If you don't believe me, you can ask the Apostle simulation folks, the Auriga simulation folks, the Niehaus simulation folks. Justin Reed and Dennis Urquhart had a really nice analysis using abundance matching arguments. Everyone finds there's no missing satellites problem, so please let's not pretend that it's still a problem. All right, so if it's just comparing the mass function, that's great, although I think it's worth asking about a more rigorous test, which is not getting the mass distribution of the dwarfs right, but also if we can actually match their spatial distribution, since after all, that's a more rigorous test. If we're actually able to resolve their infall and orbital evolution and tidal disruption in these Milky Way-like environments. And that's something my student, Jenna Samuel, has been looking at. So first of all, let's just look at how the satellites are distributed in a radial profile sense around the Milky Way and around M31. So the number of satellites inside a given distance as a function of distance from the host. And again, we're just looking at classical dwarfs here where things are perhaps reasonably complete, or at least close to it. So what's interesting about comparing the Milky Way and M31 is if you take their satellites out to a distance of about 150 kiloparsecs, they're basically the same to first approximation, basically set on top of each other. But as everyone knows, M31 has about twice the number of total satellites, at least classical satellites, as the Milky Way. The divergence happens beyond this. The Milky Way is almost entirely flat, there's a few dwarfs, but M31 basically keeps rising. So it's kind of an interesting difference. I'll come back to this in just a moment. So we can then compare against both the Milky Way and M31 about what are the radial distribution of our satellites as a function of distance. And so this is what we see. So again, the black curve here is the Milky Way. The dashed curve here is M31. The blue curve here is the median across all of our simulated hosts. And you can see the 68 and 95% scatter amongst all of our hosts. And we also time average, since, you know, the redshift zero, you may get biased answers, especially at small distances from these simulations. And then the orange curve shows our local group-like paired hosts, and then the magenta curve shows our individual Milky Way simulations. There's maybe some slight offsets, that's interesting, but by and large, it's not too big compared to the scatter. So the main takeaway message is, down to distances of like 50 kiloparsecs, out to distances of about 300 kiloparsecs, our simulations sit right between the Milky Way and M31, and with scatter that basically brackets them. So again, we're not seeing any huge discrepancies in the radial distributions of these satellites as well. We can look at that more directly by just taking the ratio of the number in the simulation to what we observe. Again, around the Milky Way, basically at all distances, our numbers within 68% scatter within our hosts are consistent with the Milky Way. We see a bit fewer than M31. Again, M31 has quite a lot of satellites, and I think this is probably just a statement that maybe M31's halo mass is a bit higher than what we've chosen to simulate here. But again, I just want to say that the broad story here is good consistency, even at small distances where resolving these is historically been challenging. So coming back to here, again, I just want to note this stark differences in the outer radial profiles. This isn't a new statement, so actually there's a nice paper by Iniguez, James Bullock, and the Irvine group had some years back pointing out this difference, so it piqued our interest. And so we're trying to understand what this might be telling us. So one option is that the Milky Way is just an unusually concentrated satellite distribution. The other option, of course, is maybe we're still missing classical dwarfs out there. So we can try the simple exercise to ask whether this is possibly consistent with our simulations. So we can take only our simulated hosts and only at snapshots that exactly match the number of satellites around the Milky Way out to 150 kiloparsecs. And see then what the prediction is for how many satellites there are beyond 150 kiloparsecs. So it's sort of putting a strong prior on the satellite distributions. So here's what we see. So again, the black curve is the Milky Way, and the blue curve is our simulations with a 68% scatter. Again, if we prior on exactly matching the number at 150, you can see just how bang on our simulations are with the Milky Way down to 50 kpc. So again, this gives me confidence that we're actually resolving them reasonably well. But the interesting thing is, if we go out to 300 kiloparsecs, we don't see any of our simulations. This is 12 hosts and about 15 snapshots per host, so it gives us about 150 realizations to choose from, and we don't see any as concentrated as the Milky Way. So that either means, again, the Milky Way is quite unusual, which could be, or that our completeness, even down to the nominal classical dwarf limit of 10 to the 5, our observations are still incomplete. A few years ago, I would have a little more trepidation saying this, but the discoveries of Crater 2 and Antlia 2 give me a little bit more confidence as a theorist to put this out there as a prediction. Yep. I think there's a lot more work to do. In principle, our simulations can help model how the disk is itself acting to obscure background satellites, but this is just a first pass suggestion that I think I'm increasingly convinced that maybe there are more out there to be discovered. Well, remember, there's a strong prior here on the number, that the number has to exactly match the Milky Way out to 150. So you may not end up with a Poisson distribution anymore because of the prior you put in. What? Yes, we've included Crater 2 and Antlia 2 in these predictions, in these Milky Way compilation. So it says it's up to date, unless any of you have more satellites to be discovered you haven't told us about yet.
Okay.
So one last comment. One of the reasons we get good agreement in these simulations is, maybe I'm preaching to the choir, but these baryonic simulations form central disks. And I just highlight a paper that Shea Garris and Kimmel led a few years ago where we just compared a dark matter-only version of one of our simulation to the baryonic version that forms a disk. And you can just, this isn't even a subtle difference. You can see by eye the huge difference in the amount of substructure in the inner 100 kiloparsecs when you form a disk versus if you just rely on a dark matter-only simulation. So just to emphasize, I think we should be awfully skeptical about results from dark matter-only simulations making predictions about substructure near the disk region. And in fact, again, this is one of the reasons we're getting agreement with the Milky Way is we don't overproduce the number of luminous satellites at small distances. And for a while, though, this made me quite skeptical about the whole enterprise of looking at subhalo stream interactions, because at least in our first two simulations in this paper, we found zero surviving subhalos inside of about 20 kpc at redshift zero in those first two simulations. But I think this is worth revisiting, and so that's what we're doing now. And so this is a paper led by my undergrad, Sierra Chapman, who's now quantifying the actual infall rate of low-mass dark subhalos in these simulations. So the subhalo infall rate as a function of distance from the host, looking at different masses. This is the bound dark matter masses of the subhalos. And again, you can see the prediction from the baryonic simulation versus the dark matter-only version of the same simulation. So again, you can see the order of magnitude difference between the two. But just to say, if you look at sort of subhalo masses of potential interest for subhalo stream modeling, right, a 10 to the 7, if you look at sort of, for instance, the GD1-ish distances, we're getting of order 10 coming in at that distance per giga year. And if you go down to 10 to the 6, it's up by maybe 50 or 60 per giga year. So I think I've regained much optimism about this whole enterprise, and I think we'll be hearing more about that later. So I just wanted to give you some perspective, our perspective, on the predicted infall rates of dark substructures. So that's the end of my talk. So I want to give you some highlights of some of the interesting features we see in these cosmological simulations, thin plus this thick disk formation, multiple alpha tracks in the stellar populations. This I had to skip. You can ask me about it later if you're interested in about in-situ versus ex-situ stars. And we're able to start making good agreement now with the predicted, not just the mass distribution of satellites, but their actual spatial distributions as well. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Questions? You can pick, Anna.
So this didn't make a bar. How much more mass would have been needed to?
So we had one of our simulations that did make a bar. So Victor De Batista had a paper where he looked at that. It was a transient bar, though. So it formed about 2 or 3 giga years before redshift zero, and then it completely buckled and formed a boxy peanut bulge like we see in the Milky Way. It's an interesting question how generalizable that is. I will just note that we don't see, in our simulations, we do not generally see long-lived bar structures. They tend to be transient.
I have a question about the molecular clouds.
Yes.
And how long-lived they are and whether they are bound.
So I can't answer the long-lived thing. That's basically what Sam Benincasa is looking at now, because we want to quantify their lifetimes, which is an interesting question. How bound they are, I don't think I have a plot here, but there's a range of alpha parameters, which again, exactly like we observed in the Milky Way, and it's the molecular clouds with alpha less than about 1, so that are actually self-gravitating, where stars form. But of course, there's a lot of molecular clouds that aren't self-gravitating, and they're not forming stars, which again, is exactly what we see in the Milky Way. So we do see a range of how bound the clouds are.
I had two questions about the double alpha tracks.
Yep.
So the first one, I think I can guess the answer to, but it's, do the double tracks have different kinematics of the stars that are forming?
Yes, and I had to skip that for time.
I thought they would, yeah. So they do have cooler in the lower track and hotter kinematics in the upper track.
Right, so here is just taken from Hayden et al. The spatial dependence of the high and low alpha tracks as observed in the Milky Way. Here's what we see in the simulation. So if you look at small r, large z, we basically just see the high alpha track At intermediate radius and intermediate height in the disk, we see both. And at large R and small vertical height, we just see the lower alpha track. Or if you prefer, I can just show you an image of the two. Mm-hmm. That again, at least qualitatively maps onto what we see in the Milky Way.
Right, thanks. And the second question was, the systems that only have one track.
Yes, the counterfactual systems.
Yeah, do they not have,
I don't have a great
any
answer to
gas-rich
mergers? No, they do. And this is what we're looking at now, is what doesn't drive those to have multiple
alpha
tracks?
Yeah, I think that's intriguing.
We're looking at this
now.
Yeah,
okay, thank you.
Maybe we should go to this side of the room.
Do your disks have warps, and are they transient or long-lived?
We haven't quantified that carefully, so I don't have a great answer, but I can certainly point you to some images of disks that are highly warped. And they generally are flared, in fact. That's actually more common than not, which I think makes sense from the perspective of the hydrostatic equilibrium of the cold gas, that you generally get flaring of the cold gas disk.
Just two quick fire questions. With 10 million stars, I'm asking, do you see migration? And
yes.
Secondly, there's a big fuss about dwarfs being in planes in M31 Milky Way. Do you see planes of dwarfs?
That's Jenna's follow-up project. In fact, she started there, and we realized we had to get a better understanding of the radial
was
distributions
that yes or no?
Before. I don't know yet. I can't give you a very careful answer.
What about migration?
Yes, so Sarah Lohman has been looking at that as well. It's there. I can't give you a much more detailed answer yet, other than to say that certainly stars are migrating. Is there something specific you just want to know about that? Oh, yeah, so we haven't tried to quantify how dominant it is compared to other sources of heating and scattering. No, I don't have a great answer to that yet.
Yes, your disk had multiple spiral arms. It's not a grand design two-armed or three-armed spiral, which is what we most commonly see. And you haven't shown us a rotation curve or a mass disk decomposition. So can you tell me how dark matter dominated it is?
That's a radial-dependent statement. I can show you rotation curves. I don't have them in slides, but I could show you from one of our papers after offline. You asked about how dark matter dominated the disks are.
Disks are dark matter dominated. We prefer multiple spiral arms.
Yeah, so Robin has a student who's been looking at the spiral structure. Do you want to?
Yeah, I think just say generically. So they're not too much different than what people are thinking for the Milky Way, in the sense that the dark matter and baryonic mass inside the solar circle is comparable. That depends a little bit from simulation to simulation. But when you calculate the number of estimated spiral arms that you get, it is pretty high. So it's consistent with what we see to the extent that we can try to calculate it. But what actually kept us from making any progress with that study was the time between snapshots that we were saving. So I had to go back and, in order to track one spiral arm from place to place, save a higher frame rate. So, and that, this is related, right? Because the mechanism that forms the spiral arms that results in these blockages is more transient than if you have a grand design that's driven by a bar or something. Mm-hmm. So there, I think that from the little checks that I've done, the number of arms that you get is sort of consistent with what you expect based on the mass ratio of dark matter to stars. We can talk later. Still
yeah, very much.
Could you explain a bit more why the inflow rate for the dark matter only and the baryonic simulation differed so much?
Oh, sure. Let me see if I can get that slide. Right, so thanks. I meant to say a few more words exactly in this direction. So I think to coming back to this plot, right? So basically what we find is that generally speaking, either luminous or dark subhalos that orbit closer than about 20-ish kpc from the disk tend to get destroyed with reasonably high efficiency. And so in this case, what you're seeing is basically substructure that's passed through get tidally shock heated and basically evaporated after it does its first passage, whereas in the dark matter only case, you can have multiple orbits. So I think the difference you're seeing between these, of course, in the case of the baryonic simulations, your subhalos are coming in, you may get one infall passage, and then they get entirely destroyed. In the dark matter only case, you're basically allowing multiple passages after they fall in. So basically the difference here is largely driven by subhalos that are falling in for the second, third, fourth, fifth time that got destroyed in the case where there was a disk there.
Thank you.
So Andrew, very nice talk. The plot you just showed of the baryons versus the dark matter, and it looks to me, by eye, that the one with baryons there might have a dark matter core in the middle. Is that true? And yeah. If so, what's the mechanism?
Good question. So James and I were just talking about this. So there's it varies from run to run, but there is some amount of coring-ish. Sorry, how to phrase. So let me back up. So we find that in our, which I didn't get a chance to touch on, dwarf galaxies of a certain mass, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9 at redshift 0, form cores. As it was forming, these Milky Way progenitors also form cores. So if you looked at our Milky Way progenitors at redshift 3, there was a strong core there, like in our simulations predict for LMC mass galaxies at redshift 0. Now, what happens, what seems to happen that I don't think we have a great understanding of, is somehow the gas cooling into the disk relaxes the profile back to NFW-ish, with emphasis on the ish. And I think the exact details on that tell you if it, you know, there's no reason it should relax exactly back to NFW. In some cases, it can overshoot and actually get higher density, but the profile itself ends up flattened. So you can get a core-like profile, but that doesn't actually mean you have a deficit of density. If anything, you have a slightly enhanced density at larger distances. And that kind of qualitatively seems to be what we're seeing. But I think we need to flesh that out that more carefully.
That's a possible feature of baryonic contraction, right?
Justin wrote a paper on the late and the related where it's like, there's two things going on. It's adiabatic contraction makes stuff denser.
Well, also, to be clear, it's not adiabatic.
Yeah, it's not adiabatic.
I think we should avoid using that phrase. Yeah.
But then the other thing that's going on is you blow out cores, and then if you have a dark matter mainly merger, that refills the lost cone, we can also rebuild a cusp. So you can rebuild a cusp after the blowout if you have a dark matter dominated merger, and then you can create a new core after more feedback happens. So it's a very complicated mixture of stuff that's going on.
But I think the point, which I think you agree, there's no reason to expect these to be exactly NFW by any means, and it will depend on their formation history, I think.
Thank you.
So I wanted to return to the picture that you put up really early on, which you said was a Milky Way analog, and then someone from the floor pointed out it was rather asymmetric.
Yeah.
Well, is the origin of that asymmetry? I mean, a perturber will probably drive bisymmetric tidal forces, so it wouldn't produce the kind of asymmetry that you see there, I don't think.
In this case, I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Your parents don't slosh in the dark matter halo.
Oh, yes, they can. They do slosh. We were working on that last week. They slosh non-trivially, in fact.
So I think it's going to be our last question.
Huh, lucky me. So do you have analogs of Crater 2 and Antlia 2? And if yes, what sort of star formation histories do they have?
I looked at this like for a day in Shanghai, and then I haven't returned to it.
I know it's boring.
We do have some that are not exactly as diffuse, but close to as diffuse as Antlian Crater. But I have not looked in detail at their formation histories. So I think that's on our list of things. Long list of things to do. Yeah.
There's a lot of puffy things.
There's a lot of puffy things, I will say that. Maybe too many, in fact. That's something I had to skip as well.
Maybe, does anyone have a really short question? We could do it. Otherwise, we should move on. Okay.
I'm curious about how your bar is dissolved. You know that recently Jerry and I had a paper on M33. We basically find it puzzling that M33 does not have a bar, does not have a bar.
Oh yeah.
It has only a very weak bar, and we tried very hard to destroy the bar or prevent the bar from forming. And we didn't succeed, and we even tried the gizmo simulations, including gas. and your simulation always seems like always on bar. Maybe you have solved our puzzle. So how do you, my point is that how do you avoid the bar from forming in this kind of simulations?
I don't have a deep answer to you for that question. Like I said, we just looked at the one case where we do find a transient bar. It may have to do with, if I would make a guess, I would say it might have to do with dispersion of gas at small radius. But there's some slightly overestimate of how much turbulence there is in the axon, and therefore how hot the stars are forming out of this. That could act as a blurring mechanism to help wash out the formation of small-scale phase structures, but that's just an amazing guess, since we haven't looked at this.
Do you know what else? They should go back and look at Mercury.
Oh, but they're all near one.
They're all near one.
I'm not sure, but I don't think it's just that.
Okay, great discussion. Let's thank Andrew again. And Ted Makarath is going to be talking about unraveling the assembly of the Milky Way.